There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. My guest today is Bobby Gallagher, the CEO and Chief Technical Officer of Deployable Energy, a name that many of you may not have heard. They've been pretty quiet until very recently. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to be here, Rod. We're starting to make a name for ourselves. We like to show people what we've done as opposed to what we're going to say we're going to do. So we've started to complete some milestones. So we're telling people who we are.
I'm always appreciative of those who do rather than those who talk about maybe doing something sometime down the road. But anyway, tell us a little bit about Deployable Energy and what made you decide to become a nuclear entrepreneur.
Yeah, it's a fascinating journey, really. But yeah, so Deployable Energy, we're a Houston-based microreactor company. We're developing the Unity nuclear battery. It's a 1 megawatt microreactor. It's LEU, 5% LEU fueled. Standard UO2. You can put this fuel in a PWR. It's light water moderated and it's helium cooled, and it looks a little bit like a baby CANDU reactor. It's a pressure tube reactor as opposed to a pressure vessel reactor. In terms of how I got into this space, it was really my background's heavy industry, offshore oil and gas, shipbuilding, military, venture backed startups. And I saw a lot of problems with energy being a key constraint in the offshore oil and gas space. And the original thesis was that it might be easier to deploy microreactors in that environment than onshore. Now, that was 3 or 4 years ago now. The whole world's changed since then. But that's how I got into it. Initially, it was to power offshore installations. And I can tell you more on where we are now and what we're doing now, but that's how I got into this space. So I'm a VC backed entrepreneur. I've had a successful exit, but deeply in the weeds in terms of first principle thinking. How do I solve problems? How do I move regulators? How do I move stakeholders in adopting new solutions?
This idea of gas-cooled reactors with water moderation is not completely unprecedented, but it's pretty unusual. Most of the time, gas-cooled reactors are moderated by something of a higher temperature capacity like graphite. Now, how hot is the water that you use in as your moderator?
Not very. It's basically it'd be probably colder than your hot water tap, depending on which part of the world you're in, and it's completely unpressurized. So the whole pursuit is neutron diffusion and limiting that neutron diffusion length, and there's really no better material in slowing neutrons, thermalizing neutrons, than cold water.
How does it affect your reactor size compared to a graphite moderator reactor? Water, certainly being H2O, is one of the almost ideal moderators because it has an awful lot of very lightweight hydrogen atoms in it. Graphite, of course, being C12, doesn't have quite as good a elasticity for slowing down those neutrons bouncing around. How big would a graphite moderated version of your reactor have to be?
I think what you're alluding to between light water and carbon is the moderating power effect between the two materials. And moderating power is one of the most important metrics for microreactor design. And so what does this mean? To give a short answer on how the size would change,
Our core being light water moderated would be is approximately a couple of feet across and a couple of feet long. If it were to be graphite moderated, to maintain the same spectrum or similar spectrum, it would need to be 8 feet across and 8 feet long. That has huge implications, and I can break this down a little bit more. And I might use some historical analogies just to give you a feel. The AGR, the advanced gas-cooled reactors, developed by the UK, the graphite to UO2 volume ratio within that core was about 50 to 1. So for every unit, 50 units of graphite, you had 1 unit of UO2 fuel. For LWRs, that ratio is about 2 to 1. So for every 2 units of light water, you have 1 unit of UO2. And so that's a huge difference in power density. It's a huge difference in the size of the core. And so what does that mean if we were to translate that to the Unity nuclear battery? It would mean our core weight would have to go up 10x to account for the moderator weight and the increase in vessel weight. The shielding weight would need to go up approximately 5x. The power density of the system would reduce by 25x. The transportability of the system would become very challenging because now the core is taking up essentially the whole 20-foot container. And from a SiteWorks perspective, SiteWorks scope goes up significantly. Ground pressures and weights on the site go up significantly, and that can have implications on seismic and other site considerations. So this is a really dramatic change, something that would, probably make the system untenable. And so typically the trade-off for graphite moderated microreactors is to reduce the moderator to fuel volume ratio, harden the spectrum, which leads to typically more neutrons leaking into the shielding structure and more site activation. And furthermore, you'd typically want to increase nominal power output, making the overall system bigger, again, making it less siteable, less transportable. But ultimately, you can get to a place where you have better power density and economics for a graphite moderated microreactor. So yeah, it would be fundamentally game changing if we had to use a graphite moderator instead of a light water moderator. Or put another way around, the reason why our system is so compact and deployable is 100% due to that moderating power and our light water moderation.
You recently, or maybe people of your company, I'm not sure if you were actually behind the wheel of the truck or not, moved a reactor from Houston to Idaho in a rather interesting demonstration vehicle. Can you tell us about that journey?
So at Deployable Energy, we want to build our Unity nuclear batteries in a factory setting, deliver it to a site, install, commission, and give power to the end user. We want to do that from day one. And so we set the challenge to, can we build our reactor vessel? Now, obviously, it's not fueled. It doesn't have all the shielding on it. It's a demonstration, but we're able to load our reactor vessel. It's as is. It's only a couple of 100 pounds. It's only a couple of feet around and a couple of feet high. And so we could put it in the back of an F-150 truck and drive it from our factory here in Houston to Idaho National Labs, where we're going to fuel it, connect it to the instrumentations and control system, be in a shielded structure, and go critical, fingers crossed, before the 4th of July. And so we wanted to demonstrate that and get people comfortable in and around it. And we had some great, we had a bit of fun with it. We stopped in at Texas A&M We've got a big partnership there with the largest engineering school in the nuclear engineering school in the country. We stopped in at Salt Lake City. We presented to the energy committees of the state congressional committee and the Senate committee. We had the reactor and the F-150 truck staged on the steps of the Capitol there at Salt Lake City, and I'd recommend anyone go visit. It's unbelievably beautiful where it sits in the valley there and overlooking the valley there in Salt Lake City. And yeah, we're able to just get people close to the system, demystify it, try and break some of the misconceptions with nuclear. And we had, I could say we had senators in high heels, trying to clamber up on the bed of the truck to get a better look and be close to our system. And so that was a great stop over there at Salt Lake. We had kids and the public interacting with the system. And then we did the final leg to INL, where we dropped it off at the materials fuel complex. We have a site within INL there that we installed the reactor in. And you asked if I drove. Like a typical CEO, I did the glory runs, Rod. I did the run from Houston to Texas A&M, and then I did the run from Salt Lake City to Idaho National Lab. So I did all the fun glory runs, and the team, my other co-founders, we shared the load, and they did a lot of the fun stuff through West Texas and Colorado and Lower Utah, Southern Utah, and up to Salt Lake City. So yes, I did do some time, but I did all the photo shoots, so to speak.
So tell us a little bit more about what a complete Unity battery might look like, and how would it be transported? As you and I know, obviously, reactors have to be shielded. There has to be a pretty good barrier of thick materials that keeps the gammas inside, protects the public from the neutrons. So what does a shielded version look like?
Sure. That's a great question. So yeah, the Unity nuclear battery, it's a 1 megawatt system. It's designed for distributed energy dense power applications. It's containerized and modular. So there's a nuclear island. There's a reactor module that fits within a 20-foot container. It has some of the primary shielding associated with it, and just due to our size of our core, we can fit quite a lot of shielding on that 20-foot container. Not necessarily all of it, but quite a lot. Then there's a 40-foot container that's the balance of plant that holds a lot of the power conversion systems, the power conditioning systems, and what we're calling the on-site monitoring station, not necessarily the control room. And we can talk about control methodologies and that, how we want to operate the system there. And then there's depending on the site, you can add a 40-foot air cooler that provides the ultimate heat sink to air for the balance of plant for the reactor. And so yeah, it's those three modules, and then depending on the site, we could have the nuclear island subterranean, or above grade inside a protected structure, a modular concrete structure that finish the rest of the shielding, but primarily protect the nuclear island from potential external threats from natural to other threats.
All right, yeah, introduce the topic. What does the control system look like? Is this something that's going to be remotely controlled? Is it going to be site operators? What's the strategy there?
So the beauty with our reactor system is that we have some great reactor physics that limits some of the traditional limitations with respect to xenon feedback, iodine pits, etc. And so we can essentially, once it's up at temperature, once started up, the main control mechanism for reactor power is actually the cooling flow through the reactor. So if you want more power, you just basically turn up the helium blower through the system. If you want less power, you basically turn it down. So it has this very elegant load following characteristic. And so yeah, for that normal operation, we see it being just there's just monitoring of the system. There's no such thing as a diesel generator operator. Yeah, but there is an emergency stop that you can probably press pretty close by to a diesel generator. We have the same philosophy. You can monitor the system, you can see it. If you don't like something, you can just press the E stop. But the reactor itself, with its control system, can basically vary power to meet the load as needed. And Part 57, the latest regulatory rules that have been proposed, allows those sorts of control figure configurations. Obviously, it'll be validated. We'll build it out. We'll show and prove that the control system's robust. But with that, then yeah, you can have, depending on your cyber posture, remote control. You could have centralized control on site of a fleet of these reactors, depending on whether you need 1 megawatt of power, 10 megawatts of power, 100 megawatts of power, 1,000 megawatts of power. So we have optionality. Could it be remotely controlled? Definitely. Could it be controlled by a control room if the customer really wanted to do that? Definitely. Could we aggregate it and have one control room for a fleet of systems? Yes. So there's a bit of flexibility there.
Do you see the 1 megawatt electric, or I guess it's probably about 3 megawatts or so thermal reactors being the optimal size, and you'll just scale by adding more units? Or do you foresee some time where you might want to scale that to a different size for different uses?
So we believe we'll have very good economics at the 1 megawatt electric size. Could we go larger? Yes, but you start very rapidly complicating the site construction. We want to make this as universally siteable as possible. Small reactors are less efficient than big reactors. Neutron diffusion is the bane there, and leakage out of the core into the shielding structure is always a bane of small reactors. But if you can be small enough to be able to co-locate and easily be siteable, you can use not only the electrical power that's generated by the system, but you can also use traditionally the waste heat that comes off the power conversion cycle to power district heating or low-grade heating processes, or run absorption cool systems to run chill water systems. And we see a tremendous amount of synergies there, where we can get actually better efficiency out of the fuel by co-locating, because we're not putting two-thirds of the heat into the atmosphere. We can actually capture closer to 70, 80% of the heat being generated into productive uses. And that's how we see the benefits of being small. Could we go larger? I think yes, but you do start to run into siting considerations, site construction issues, and to a lesser extent, inherent safety issues. So there is a balance there, for sure, but we can definitely fit our 1 megawatt micro reactor on a 20-foot container, make it nearly universally siteable, for most sites in the lower 48, and Alaska and Hawaii, and potentially other applications. But that's the trade-off. There's never a perfect solution. So we're trading off ease of mass manufacture versus ease of siting and construction work.
What is the, first of all, a quick question. What's the mass of that 20-foot container?
Sure. So we have a pretty simple but novel shielding structure, where in a transportation case, it's sub 20 metric tons, and then when we get onto site, we can easily load shielding into the system and make it closer to 60 metric tons, and have the shielding required to limit doses to what's needed for regulatory compliance. So yeah, it's about the nuclear island. It's about 20 metric tons in the transportation, in the dry weight transportation mode.
That's pretty good. That fits within standard road weight limits without having to get special permissions or use especially heavy wheeled vehicles and whatnot. Next question.
I'm an oil field guy, right? And moving things around on the roads is one of the key constraints, one of the key challenges, something that we know deeply here in Houston. That's what we do. We put things on skids, we put things in containers, and we ship them to site. And able to have a, this is oil field parlance, a roughneck, be able to hit it with a hammer, and it still work. They literally hit it with a hammer to make it work, in some cases.
Give me a bigger hammer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're called hammer unions for a reason.
We used to talk about things being sailor proof, so I guess it's a similar design criteria. Tell us a little bit about your fuel itself. You said it's regular fuel, LEU. Is it regular pellets or is it something different?
It's definitely something very standard. It can be used in a, it was developed for a PWR, but it's probably not something we'll go into too much detail. But it enables a lot of the reactor physics, and safety case that we're building is the fuel form that we're working with, obviously an established player in this. In this space, we're able to sign a contract with the DOE and have fuel manufactured in about 69 days. So it's something that's you could say is relatively readily available if you can if you're able to engage a existing supplier and get it manufactured in 69 days.
So if you know the right door to knock on and the right questions to ask, I guess, is that the
The
key
right
there?
doors to knock on, the right questions to ask, and you got to have the right design. Yeah, you got to have, and that's key. And the right reactor physics. But yes, if you can line that up, you can move very quickly.
What kind of pressure does your helium need to stay?
It's relatively low pressure compared to your traditional PWR territory, but so it's pretty standard, approximately 50 bar, 50 bar pressures for high temperature gas reactors.
In case you don't naturally think in international units, a bar is approximately 14.5 pounds per square inch. 50 bar is 725 PSI. Does the helium go through a heat exchanger and produce steam, or is it some other fluid on the secondary side to turn the turbine and make electrons, or make electrons move, I should say. Nobody makes electrons.
Yeah, so Yeah, so we have discussions in place with steam turbine power conversion providers, vendors for that option. That's typically north of 30-40 megawatt deployments for those steam turbines. So in that application, yes, the primary heat exchanger is a helium to steam generator function. But we also are exploring with a number of vendors supercritical CO2 power conversion. And so we have a 1 megawatt system and a 10 megawatt system that we're working towards as well. So we got optionality on the power conversion side from your traditional steam sites for some of the bigger applications that have access to water traditionally to some of these middle applications in the tens of megawatts to these compact 1 to 10 megawatt deployments with the 1 megawatt power conversion cycle. They all have their pros and cons. Yeah, some are obviously steam turbines are TRL 9. Yeah, you can yeah if you again if you know the right people and the right supply chain, you can get them relatively quickly. And then some of these other SCO2 turbines are less further along on their TRL readiness, and obviously they're not readily available at the moment, but they're becoming readily available in the next year or two.
I'm sort of having a little challenge envisioning using a 30 megawatt steam turbine with a 1 megawatt heat source. Is you're going to need 30 reactors to produce heat for one turbine?
Think of it like how we and again I'll give an oil field analogy. We gang up 1 megawatt to 2.5 megawatt prime diesel generators to run frack fleets, and that some of these frack missiles could be which is a colloquial term for ganging up all these frack pumps could be in the 40, 50 megawatt sizes or more now. Or another analogy could be utility grade battery farms, where you have just lots of units that are modular, that's placed and ganged up to provide the power and energy requirements for a site. So we don't see it really any different from what we've seen from diesel generators, from gas turbines to batteries, to solar, to wind. We see it quite often. Lots of systems ganged up to produce energy for particular end applications. So yes, it's uncommon in the nuclear industry. Probably the enterprise is probably the closest analogy to it, I believe. And Rod, I know you're a Navy, an NR guy. You could probably, yeah. When I say enterprise, I think some people swear off it. It was a little painful at times to have that many reactors going, but there's even historical precedents for this in the nuclear game.
Sure. Enterprise had 8 reactors initially. Now, I think at the end of life, she only had 6 that were still being used because they'd been upgraded and people decided she didn't need all the power for the 8 reactors. But I think each one of those reactors, I'm trying to remember how they had it arranged with steam turbines. It may have been 4 reactors per turbine. So I guess it doesn't really matter. Once you've figured out how to do more than one, you can just keep adding. I know that the Chinese are looking at HTR 600s, which will have 6 reactor cores feeding a single steam turbine. So
Like on a I built drill ships in the shipyards of South Korea and around the world. Like some of those ships had 8 or 9 prime movers, diesel generators to power that vessel. So it's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to be modular. In the end, it's what is the unit economics, and what's the installation, commissioning, and operation profile looks like. They're the trade-offs that we're trying to work towards. Availability, especially in the when I was building rigs, availability was of utmost importance, and having more small generators provided a better availability number than having one big generator. And in a lot of these applications that we see in the market right now, especially behind the meter, availability is something that the customer is willing to pay for and of paramount importance.
Tell us a little bit about your manufacturing plans. I know that you've chosen materials and pieces that are kind of easy to put together. How many factories you're going to need? What's the capacity going to be for your first factory? That kind of stuff.
Sure. So my kids call the reactor, it looks like a trash can, because it's so small, and it just looks like a stainless steel bucket. Our methodology, everything that we do within deployable energy is about mass manufacture. We're completely allergic to anything that says batch process. We want to be able to get reactors and microreactors in particular to be a mass manufactured continuous process, similar to how you'd build an F-150 truck on a production line. And so in order to do that, you need to be really mindful of your material selection, of your processes. And what we've done is we've basically eliminated all the major forgings out of the system. There can't be an open die forge product in there, because that's just not mass manufactured. That's an engineered product. Could it be closed die forge? Yes, like that's a mass manufactured. That has a high potential for mass manufacture. And so that's just like one example. Our reactor core is boilerplate, rolled boilerplate, and pipe. These are things that obviously are literally the most commoditized materials in the world. Whilst the initial weld up on a hand by hand process is probably more expensive, it's a process that scales rapidly with robotics, with a production line. And that goes from the weld preps to the welding to the QA to the inspections to the integrity testing that happens afterwards. We're extremely mindful on that, and we've got a 58-acre facility in Houston, Texas. We have over 340,000 square feet of manufacturing space. We have a fab shop, machine shop, paint shop, a two assembly halls, 100-ton overhead cranes. We've got warehousing. We've got 18-wheeler access through and through to the site. We've got a rail spur that comes onto the site. We're positioned to truly mass manufacture reactors. There's various different grades of factory made. I'd say we're in the mass manufactured grade, and that's what we're shooting towards, as opposed to modular built, as opposed to batch process, semi-robotic batch process. We want to be fully robotic, continuous manufacture of our lines.
Why'd you decide to locate your nuclear company in the heart of America's oil and gas industry?
If you see our reactor, and there should be some good pictures on the internet, it looks like a shell and tube heat exchanger. It looks like something that we put in terms of we Houston, we put on the back of trucks, deploy to sites, whether it's an oil and gas site, whether it's an industrial site, and make it work. Houston has, that workforce. If I were to say, and that skill set, if I was to say Detroit, that means automotive. If I was to say Silicon Valley, that means software. If I was to say Taiwan, that means chips. Houston is all about energy infrastructure that's deployable to sites. That's what Houston does better than anywhere else in the world. That's why we're located right in the heart of the energy corridor, where a good portion of the world's energy infrastructure is designed, built, deployed, and ensures the lifestyle that we live right now. And so we're leveraging that to the highest degree.
So you're going to be deployable, obviously, that's your name. How do you get your product to market? Does it depend on how close the customer is? Is there a way to move this across the world? What's going on there?
So we like to factory build, factory fuel. Our system, again, due to its compactness, its package will meet the Part 71 regs in terms of shipability of special nuclear materials. And so we would like to factory build, factory fuel, deploy to a site, whether it be by road, by rail, by ships. At this size, definitely by air. That would be obviously a very special client that would want it air delivered. But 100% focused on levelized costs, and being able to get to sites where traditional infrastructure has not met the challenge that's required for the site. So that's how we see our deployment strategy, and then we'd bring the system back, depending on the sites. If they're relatively small scale, we would send it back to a centralized facility, refuel, and basically swap and go the nuclear island. The propane bottles run out of gas. Find another valve connection, hook that up, keep the operations going, and then on that other site, you'd take away the used system and put in a new one. On bigger sites, and we have sites that we're working with project developers that have up to 2 gigawatts of capacity. That's 2,000 units. It's about 60 acres per gigawatt, so 120 acres. So it's actually quite small in terms of its footprint. That scale would enable on-site refueling, and we would establish a refueling on site. So there's a tip over point. Like everything, there's a trade-off when it makes sense to set up factory refueling or on-site refueling.
If you decide to do it, either way, what are you going to do with the materials you take out of the reactor? You're just going to use a standard dry cask or maybe a smaller dry cask? And how many are you going to be able to store before you run out of space?
It's good. That's a great question. We've got 36 acres of undeveloped land, so we've got a bit of land. But we are really encouraged by some of the developments in closing the cycle. I had the pleasure of being at the ENRIC program review, and I would say probably 20% of the developers there are working on closing the cycle, and so we see our spent fuel as being fuel for the next generation of reactors. And so I don't think, obviously, right now with the regs as is, yes, you dry cast storage is the way forward. But I'm seeing and I'm hoping that within the next 10 years or so, next 5, 10 years, we will start seeing economic options to close the cycle, to support a plutonium economy, for fast reactors and breeder reactors and other waste burning reactors, that should help alleviate some of those concerns in the long run. There's been a lot of fits and starts in this space, but I think the right time is now to start working on that solution, and I would encourage those in that space to keep moving forward.
You've talked quite a bit about envisioning mass deployment of your systems, but any kind of new product, at least in my opinion, has got to have early adopter customers who really need the capabilities that their new product can provide and may be willing and able, because of the kind of value that they would get from it, to pay a bit higher price. Where do you see as your early adopter customers in general?
It's a great question. We are working through a number of different first to market options. The one I would say that I really like is the fire to fission, the natural gas to nuclear options. This hybrid option where the customer doesn't take on a lot of risk. They still have the natural gas option whilst you build out and get the availability up on your system to supplement, a bottoming cycle on a site. And so that one there I like, it's really attractive. There's a number of maritime applications that have a very similar profile to that, where because of our size, because of our footprint, you can initially go to market in a hybrid arrangement where you still have the capabilities of your traditional hydrocarbon systems, and you're basically displacing hydrocarbon use. So they're the first ones that I see. It's the lowest risk for adopters, you don't need to necessarily swallow the whole site profile to start off with. You just incrementally bring on and displace hydrocarbon consumption on that site, whether that be a ship or a site. And that I'm not sure if Rod, you speak with everyone. I'm not sure that if that's a different go-to-market plan to others, but we're excited about that application.
One of the applications that always excited me re regarding small reactors, even dating back to when I tried to be a SMR developer myself, was islands, because
Yes.
many islands simply can't accommodate large power systems. So they're limited to burning something like diesel fuel, a premium fuel, just to provide electricity. I think you have a little bit of personal experience with islands. What do you think of that market?
That's exactly that's exactly the market that I'm thinking of, where again, you still have the diesel infrastructure there. You can still choose to burn the diesel, but you start incrementally deploying your reactors and displacing those generators. And islands have, maybe just to double click on just how powerful this is. We did a study with the Fijian government. Approximately 10 to 12 percent of their GDP is spent on diesel. Some of their places on the diesel grid, electric grid, are paying north, closer to $1,000 a megawatt hour for power. Now, these are remote islands, but upwards of over $400 a megawatt hour in some of the bigger urban centers. We see us been able to incrementally displace that diesel consumption, be able to give maybe more than a 60%, closer to 70% reduction in electrical costs over time, and or even more than that, and essentially give back single digit points of GDP back to these countries, in terms of their economies, to spend on other things, but more importantly, make these economies more productive. And and furthermore, waters, fresh water's typically a key constraint on a lot of these islands, these communities, especially during tourism seasons, etc., where tourists typically like to use a lot of hot water. There's hot tubs and pools and
And
showers,
showers.
etc. And so fresh water is typically a key constraint, and hot water is typically a key constraint. And being able to use the again, traditionally the waste heat of the reactor for desalination purposes and hot water delivery is something that you can do with 1 megawatt micro reactor to power a resort or to power a community, etc. So the size is important. These are not traditional nuclear. We're not focused on displacing grid. The grid scale. We 100% believe that, similar to, you need a 500 megawatt gas turbine, as well as needing a 2.5 megawatt gas turbine, as well as needing a 50 kilowatt diesel generator to your lawnmower running on gas. We believe there'll be a spectrum of nuclear solutions, but we want to be the lowest cost solution in that forward deployable space. And we think we can do it at 50, 60%, the reduction compared to the cost of diesel. And so islands are a perfect example of how we could change the game then.
Yeah, I like the way you said they're limited in freshwater because islands obviously have plenty of water around, but
Yes.
water everywhere and sometimes not a drop to drink,
Oh,
as
yeah.
the old man in the sea used to say.
100%.
So, Bobby, we've been talking a while. I'd like to give you the opportunity. What is there something about deployable energy that you want the world to know? You guys have been pretty quiet recently. I think I did recently see a an announcement that you had been selected as one of the first cohort for the Nuclear Energy Launchpad program. That sounds pretty exciting to me. Tell us more.
Yes, so yeah, we're really proud to be selected by the DOE to be one of 4 companies to be selected under the Nuclear Energy Launchpad program. It does give us this ability to use the DOE process to deploy our first of a kind reactors, and the same team, the same group of individuals that have supported us in getting to criticality, and touch wood, we'll be there in the next next 6, 8 weeks or so. That same team can then help support a first of a kind deployment under 2 different programs. So one is a nuclear energy launchpad INL, and that's where we're going to do all our hard testing. This is where we're going to do all our off nominal, our design basis accident events. The beauty about our system, the fuel is about $1.5 million. The reactor, first of a kind, sub $7, $8 million to build. We're going to be able to put it through its paces, be inspired by what EBR2 did by doing a loss of coolant accident. We're going to do that and more to prove our safety case, our inherent safety case at INL. And then with the Nuclear Energy Launchpad USA, We want to be the first to deploy in the maritime space with that with this special license that we've been given or ability to apply for this license under Launchpad USA. We want to be not only do we want to, like I said at the start, we want to just show people what we've done as opposed to tell people what we're going to do. We're going to build our first system co-located on our manufacturing site. It will power our machine shops and our fab shops and our paint shops, etc. And it will also provide the heat for our air conditioning system. And so we can show our customers, this is how you go behind the meter. This is how you can be nearly universally sightable. This is how you can operate and be more efficient and have nuclear energy basically decarbonize and provide energy abundance. And so with this program, we hope to hit all three of those objectives. All the hard stuff in INL, how it's actually going to work on land at our facility and make some waves with the first privately backed civilian nuclear maritime demonstrator. So we've got a big ambitious couple of years ahead of us, Rod.
That's darned exciting, but keeps you motivated. How does it feel to be on that cutting edge in a industry that seems to be ready to take off?
This is what I love to do, Rod. Like after I exited my previous business, I didn't need to work, I think I sent the wife crazy enough to know that I'm like a pack mule. If I'm not loaded up and working, I start to kick and spit, and so I don't see this as work. This is an absolute. This is passion. This is what I love to do. I love to figure out the first principles of a problem. I love to then work the stakeholder regulatory angle to it, and then generate value for the customers and all the other stakeholders. So I just this isn't work for me. Well, this is I'd be doing this anyway. If the limelight or not, it's become a passion of mine.
Terrific. Now I will go back and let you. What do you have any concluding remarks? I'm sorry. I sometimes get to the conclusion and realize, wait, I didn't ask everything I wanted to ask.
No, well, yeah, I think, yeah, the conclusion I think is please follow and track our progress. We're looking for, if you're interested and passionate about changing the world and nuclear energy, if you're willing to be in and around either Houston or the Washington area. We're looking for great people. We're scaling up quick. We have a design that's 100% focused on scaling rapidly now with the existing fuel supply chain, with the existing materials and mass manufacturability. America makes products, not projects anymore. We make planes really well. We don't necessarily make airports that well anymore. If you believe in that mission, I'd ask, reach out. We're looking for great people all the time, and appreciate your platforming deployable energy here, Rod. You've been a great source of knowledge and inspiration. Whether it's been reading Atomic Insights or our discussions along the way. So again, appreciate the time today, and you're doing a great. You're doing God's work in getting the nuclear energy story out. So I'd say that to finish off, Ron.
Well, thank you. And if anybody was watching this video, but we don't do video, I'd be blushing. But hey, Bobby, what is the URL for deployable energy?
It's a
You know that
it's
off the top of your
deployable.
head?
The URL it's yeah it's deployable.energy. So
Wow.
www.deployable.energy.
Okay. All right. So deployable energy, you can find that. Bobby Gallagher was my guest today. As you might have heard, Bobby is not from the United States originally. He is Australian, right?
Yes. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Australian, of Anglo-Irish, and yeah, a whole heap of other heritage, but yes, made my way here to the US like so many others, on a
And your
plane.
military service, what did you do again? I'm sorry, I'm asking the questions right at the very end here, but
No worries. Yeah, I'm yeah, fourth generation to serve in the Australian military. Did my time during the War on Terror. I spent most of my time dealing with countermeasures to IEDs. Yeah, it was a rough time in some respects. All about engineering solutions to save lives in the military, and then oil fields, built rigs all over the world with diamond offshore drilling. Learned the learned a lot of problems about big projects and mass manufacture, and from Korea to Japan to China to European factories to the US. And I did a startup, had a successful exit, making sure that we would never have another disaster like Deepwater Horizon occur. With my first VC backed venture. I've had a blessed career. Spanning the globe, dealing with problems, predominantly making things either safer, or more environmentally friendly.
terrific. All right, Bobby, take care. Enjoy your weekend. I think you've got another busy weekend of talk, a bit busy week ahead of you, talking more about deployable energy, traveling around the world, leaving your family behind, but having fun while you're doing it. Take care.
Thank you, Rod.
This is Rod Adams, host of the Atomic Show and Atomic Insights. I've been providing insights into atomic energy and advocating for better nuclear industry performance and accelerated growth since 1995. I hope you've had the chance to enjoy and learn from many of these posts and podcasts. But that's not all I'm doing. 6 years ago, I entered into a partnership that lets me invest into some of the most exciting young companies in the energy industry. With my partner, Valerie Gardner, we launched Nucleation Capital Fund I, a non-traditional venture fund to focus on investing into ventures that we believe are well-positioned to flourish. Those companies will help us all reduce dangerous dependence on fossil fuels by using ever-increasing amounts of abundant, affordable, dependable, and clean nuclear energy. If you are an accredited investor, you can join us. What makes us non-traditional is that we allow regular people to invest in innovative private ventures in amounts from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars. We reduce costs and risk by building diversified portfolios using an online venture fund custodian. That custodian can help you determine if you qualify under SEC rules as an accredited investor and helps make our fund accessible and affordable. Investors subscribe at the level they can afford for the number of quarters they prefer. We've made 25 investments and we continue to see many exciting investment opportunities. If you believe in the long-term prospects of nuclear energy and want to put a portion of your patient investment dollars to work, please reach out, as every quarter we make one to three investments, but you have to be subscribed to get an allocation. Please visit our website, nucleationcapital.com, where you'll find a wealth of information. That's nucleationcapital, all one word, .com. If the content you find stimulates you to take the next step towards investing, please fill out an investor interest form.
There's a way, such a better way today. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.